This is the Line 4 podcast. I'm Will Bardwell. When Melinda and King Martin brought their second boy, Casey, home from the hospital in 1972, they realized pretty quickly that something wasn't quite right. He cried constantly. All babies cry, of course. But Casey's crying seemed different. There was pain behind it. He thrashed around constantly. And nearly every night he woke up screaming. But nothing appeared to be out of the ordinary, except for an odd purple birthmark on the baby's right leg. By the time Casey Martin turned 5, his doctors had figured out what was behind both the birthmark and the pain. Something called Klippel-Trenaunay syndrome, or KTS. It's a rare disorder in which blood vessels in a certain area of the body never finish developing and aren't strong enough to pump blood away. In Casey's case, the KTS affected the bone in his lower right leg. Without healthy blood circulation, the bone never finished developing. It's thin, weak, and brittle, and there's no cure. But even on a bad right leg, Casey could stand up. And as it turns out, he could stand up to the most powerful pro golf circuit in the world and some of the most famous players of all time. And 20 years ago this May, the United States Supreme Court stood with him. On May 29th, 2001, the Supreme Court ruled 7-2 in PGA Tour versus Martin that the Americans with Disabilities Act required the PGA Tour to accommodate Martin's disability by allowing him to use a golf cart. The decision never promised Martin anything. And in fact, Martin didn't go on to great success on the tour. But the decision gave Martin the same thing that the ADA gives every other American with a disability. A chance. And that was all Martin ever wanted. Today, on the Line 4 podcast, we look back on the occasion of the decision's 20th anniversary at PGA Tour versus Martin, at the case's backdrop, at the decision's legacy, and at the man at the center of it all.
So, I mean, my disability has been defining for me since I was born, really. My earliest recollection of it was about 5 years old and being diagnosed with something and having to get stockings for my leg. And I can remember pulling the stockings on, and that was some of my earliest life memories.
That's Casey Martin. He turns 49 this year. And since 2006, Martin has served as the men's golf coach at the University of Oregon.
And one thing that's always been part of my life is sports. Grew up sitting behind the bench in Oregon football and basketball games, and I just lived and breathed it like all my other buddies. And we played in the yard and did everything. The challenge for me is every time I did that, I would come back in fairly significant pain. And, you know, so it was a tearful thing for me to go and play basketball or play some football in the yard or whatever when I was, you know, 7-8 years old, whatever. Had one sport my dad was into. My brother got started in golf. And so I recognized at an early age that, hey, this doesn't hurt the leg quite as much. So I knew early on that sport-wise, that would be a sport I needed to pursue. But I still tried to do basketball. I mean, I played 7th and 8th grade. I can only play a quarter and a half or so. And I played soccer goalie. And I knew football wasn't ever going to be an option. But I love sports, and I saw myself, you know, being in the NBA or something one day. But a lot of reasons that wasn't going to work out. But fortunately, there was golf, and I took to it, and I've been into it since I was really 5 or 6 years old.
Having spent 15 years now as Oregon's men's golf coach is an appropriate role for Martin, who grew up in Eugene and was a decorated college golfer, but not at Oregon. At Stanford, where he was named an All-American honorable mention, a second-team All-American, and first-team All-Pac-10. About halfway through Martin's college career, though, his leg took a turn for the worse. But the NCAA allowed players with disabilities to use a golf cart, and for Martin, the pain in his leg had become too much to continue risk walking. So he started taking a cart at competitions. No big deal.
Back in your 20s, when all this was going on, what did the average day feel like for you? Like on a on a day where your leg was giving you trouble, what did it feel like?
Well, numerous kinds of pain. My leg swells up, so my veins don't work right. And so the initial look at my leg is when I have my stockings off, it will just swell up to like a really large amount. Varicose veins have some look of that, but I mean, it's intense. So I have that issue of the constant swelling and the bleeding in my knee joint and stuff that's related to the KT syndrome and whatnot. But really the pain that I've dealt with most of my life that's been more acute in a sense is a bone pain. And because of the swelling in and around my circulation just isn't ideal. And my tibia has just been compromised since I was young, you know, because of my activity and just the blood pooling in there. It's not a healthy tibia. So I had a lot of pain that way. Most of the pain would come if I was active or playing golf. Is when I got home that night, I would be in, you know, a fair amount of discomfort, bone pain and whatnot. And so that's been, I mean, a lot of my pain is at the moment, you know, which will slow me down, but a lot of it is deferred. You know, if I'm active one day that night, I get it, or that next, when I sleep, I get it. So I'd always be active and then I just knew I'd pay for it. And so you kind of try to medicate a little bit with some anti-inflammatories and get through. But, you know, I've done the best I can and pain has been a constant companion, unfortunately, but you know what? I'm still grinding it out.
Martin hadn't come to Stanford expecting to become a professional golfer. But after earning All-American honors twice, plus an all-conference nod, he'd more than earned the right to give it a shot. And the PGA Tour was watching. Martin played two full seasons on the Hooters Tour, a mini tour in the South, and walked both years. After Martin's first season, the pain in his leg got worse, so he asked the Hooters Tour to accommodate him by letting him use a cart. They said they'd get back to him. Unbeknownst to Martin, the Hooters Tour then contacted the PGA Tour and asked what they should do about Martin's request. The PGA Tour told them to deny it. So they did. Martin kept playing, but the pain was becoming unbearable. So he decided that the 1997 season would be his last, unless he could at least earn his way onto the Nike Tour, what's now called the Korn Ferry Tour, which is the main feeder circuit onto the PGA Tour. Martin sat out all but one of the last eight events on the Hooters Tour that season to rest his leg for Q School. It turned out to be a great decision. He advanced through Q School's first stage, then rallied in the final round of second stage to earn a spot in Q School finals, one step away from the PGA Tour. Now, during the first two stages of Q School, Martin, like every other player, was permitted to ride in a cart. In the Q School finals, though, players were required to walk. Martin asked the PGA Tour to make an exception in his case, to accommodate his disability. The PGA Tour refused. And that was the opening shot that began the war. The day before Thanksgiving, Martin filed a lawsuit in federal court in Oregon, arguing that the PGA Tour's refusal violated his rights under Title III of the Americans with Disabilities Act.
Broadly speaking, what does the ADA do, and how does Title III fit into that?
The ADA is a non-discrimination law. Besides the Federal Rehabilitation Act, which only applies to federal entities and recipients of federal money, the ADA kind of takes that out to the private sector and to state and local governments.
That's Professor Michael Ashley Stein, who leads the Harvard Law School Project on Disability.
So it's a non-discrimination law preventing discrimination against people with disabilities, both by state governments, local municipalities, and so on, also private employers, and also areas of public accommodation, which is Title III. Meaning any place that a person might tend to wander into and try to engage with services, whether it's a restaurant, a library, public bus, or in this case, a golf course.
The Americans with Disabilities Act was still a fairly new creation when Martin filed suit in 1997. The first President Bush had signed it into law just 7 years prior. And there were still a lot of unanswered questions about how courts would interpret and apply the ADA. But Title III of the ADA was unambiguous. It required anyone operating public accommodations to make reasonable modifications to their policies whenever that was, quote, necessary to afford such accommodations to individuals with disabilities, unless the entity can demonstrate that making such modifications would fundamentally alter the nature of such accommodations, end quote. More to the point, the ADA specifically included golf courses within its definition of public accommodations. The way the ADA is supposed to work is that someone with a disability who requests an accommodation is given an individualized assessment. That is, the details of the disability and the requested accommodation are reviewed on a case-by-case basis. But that didn't happen in Martin's case. When he and his lawyers sent the PGA Tour a package of doctor's records and video of his leg swelling up and changing colors, they assumed that the tour would immediately realize that Martin wasn't asking for a handout and that his request for a cart was legitimate. They were wrong. Now, the PGA Tour couldn't seriously contend that Martin didn't have a disability. Nor could it argue with a straight face that Martin couldn't play on the PGA Tour if his disability were accommodated. After all, he'd just played his way through the first two stages of Q School. That left the tour with just one place left to mount its defense. That is, it had to prove that letting Martin ride in a cart would fundamentally alter its tournaments.
As I remember writing probably 20 years ago, and I probably feel the same way now, I think the tour just didn't see the big picture in all this.
That's Doug Ferguson of the Associated Press, who has covered the PGA Tour for the AP since time immemorial.
I understand what they were doing. Once we give up walking now, what does that open the floodgates to? It's kind of protecting the long-term future of the game. And if we let someone ride now, then what's next? I think what the tour failed to do was look at Casey and look at the specific case and realize there was a better chance of getting another Tiger Woods before getting another Casey Martin. To be able to be that limited, with the disease, the syndrome that he had, the limited practice, the limited his ability to play and stand on the range for hours at a time, which is the only way these guys can make it out on the tour. And I'm not talking about winning. I'm just talking about getting a card. That was the exception of Casey Martin. And, I think if he just would have been able to grandfather it in, it's all hindsight, by the way, but and make the exception for him, it would have gone a lot better.
The lawsuit moved quickly. Before Q School, the federal judge in Oregon ordered the PGA Tour to provide Martin with a cart while the lawsuit developed, an early indication of whose side appeared likelier to succeed. It was the chance Martin had always hoped for. At Q School's final stage, Martin narrowly missed out on earning a PGA Tour card, but he easily qualified for a spot on the Nike Tour. He'd made it. And he didn't waste any time. Just a month and a half after filing his lawsuit, Casey Martin shot a four-day total of 19 under to win the first event on the Nike Tour's 1998 schedule, the Lakeland Classic in Florida. A month later, Martin won again, this time in an Oregon courtroom. After a week-long bench trial, that is, a trial without a jury, the judge in Martin's case ruled that the PGA Tour had violated Title III of the ADA by refusing to accommodate Martin's disability. The tour had put all its eggs into one basket by arguing that giving Martin a cart would fundamentally alter its tournaments. To support that idea, the tour had presented testimony from some of golf's biggest names, Arnold Palmer, Jack Nicklaus, Ken Venturi, to support the idea that walking was fundamental to the game of golf. Of course, by that point, Nicklaus had spent 8 years playing on the PGA Tour's senior tour, where players are allowed to ride in carts. Palmer had been playing the senior tour for nearly 20 years, Presumably, neither of them had ever testified in federal court to deprive the other of a golf cart, but never mind that. Meanwhile, Martin's lawyers inundated the judge with gripping testimony about Martin's condition. The lawyers explained that Martin was living his whole life one bad step away from the leg breaking and likely requiring amputation. They even played the video of Martin's leg that the tour had refused to watch. The whole courtroom watched in stunned silence, except for Martin, who put his head down on the table and cried, unable to watch. The judge's verdict in Martin's favor added a degree of permanence to Martin's ability to keep using a cart. And again, Martin didn't let the chance slip by. The top 15 finishers on the Nike Tour's money list graduated to the PGA Tour. And in October 1999, Martin scraped his way through the final round of the Nike Tour Championship in Dothan, Alabama, and finished the season ranked 14th on the money list. It was close, but it was good enough. Casey Martin had earned his way onto the PGA Tour. Again, Doug Ferguson of the AP.
I never got a sense that Tim was rooting against Casey.
He's referring to Tim Fincham, who at the time was the commissioner of the PGA Tour.
I never got a sense that Tim was rooting against Casey. I just kind of felt like he had to look at long-term with the tour, and he thought this was the way to go. I thought their mistake, though. I mean, once they got the injunction from the Oregon courts upheld by the federal court in San Francisco, once you took it to the Supreme Court, I think that was going a little bit too far.
When the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals affirmed the verdict in Martin's case in early 2000, nearly everyone figured that was the end of it. The Supreme Court has near full control over which cases it hears. And for all the thousands of requests that the Supreme Court gets every year to accept a case, it only takes a few dozen. So when the court does take a case, usually it's because the case offers an opportunity to clarify some legal issue that has broad applicability in courts around the country. The decision in Martin's case, though, was fairly specific to him. Almost no one thought Martin's lawsuit was the sort of case that the Supreme Court should take, including, as it turns out, at least one clerk at the Supreme Court.
My first exposure to the Casey Martin case was actually the only time I remember Justice Stevens being seriously annoyed with me.
That's Professor Andrew Siegel. Today, he teaches constitutional law and Supreme Court practice at the University of Seattle School of Law. In 2000, though, he was a recent law school grad who had just started working as a law clerk to Supreme Court Justice John Paul Stevens.
And this is a good story. I'd been there a month or two over the summer of 2000. And we were just working mostly on cert petitions, which are the applications that people send in to have their cases heard by the court. And there are thousands of them, and the court takes, 70 or so a year. So it's very hard to get cert granted. And we were working on cert petitions. Most of the other chambers participated in a pool where one clerk wrote a memo for all the eight other justices. But in our chambers, we didn't participate in the pool, and all the memos were shared among the four clerks. So we had a ton of cases. And the Casey Martin petition was one of mine.
Oh, wow.
I looked at it. And I wrote a petition where I recommended that the court deny the case. And I think I had some good arguments. It takes so few cases. This was a very specialized case. There wasn't that much at stake. There was a theoretical circuit split between this decision and a decision of the Second Circuit, meaning that there were conflicting decisions of two courts, but they were in very different kinds of cases. One was a professional golfer. One was a local tournament. And I didn't think it necessarily had the scale of impact that you look for in cases. So I wrote a petition recommending deny. And, that's fine. Sometimes the justice has a different opinion. But for one of the few times in my time there, I got a little snide in the petition, in my memo to the justice, where I said that I said something about how it just wouldn't be fair to all the litigants in really serious cases that we deny every term to take space on the court's agenda with this. And the justice came in, you know, I think he was out of town for a couple of days. He came in with a big stack of petitions. He sometimes talked to us about some of them. And he came into my office. My office is the one right next to his, actually. And, you know, he had this look on his face, and it was not angry, because he doesn't get angry. But he clearly wanted to make a point to me. And he told me that he was going to vote to grant, and that he thought the court was going to grant, and that, you know, he thought the issue had more importance. There was a split, and it had more importance than I thought it did. But that, more importantly, you know, the court has discretion on which cases to take. And this was an interesting case that he'd like to hear, and he thought his colleagues would like to hear, you know, and it didn't hurt every once in a while to take one just because they were interested.
The Supreme Court's decision to take the Martin case was shocking, for reasons not the least of which includes the fact that the Supreme Court does a lot of reversing. Between 2007 and 2019, the Supreme Court reversed, that is, it overturned the decision of a lower court, in 71% of the cases it heard. And decisions from the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, which had just ruled in Martin's favor, don't have a great track record at the Supreme Court. From 2000 to 2009, when the Supreme Court accepted a case from the Ninth Circuit, it wound up reversing the Ninth Circuit's decisions 81% of the time. All that to say that when Martin heard that the Supreme Court had decided to take his case, he was floored, and not in a good way.
Do you remember what your reaction was when you heard that your case was going to the Supreme Court?
Well, you know, after we won the first circuit, or the first go round, it was like, okay, this is great news. And then they said they would appeal, which is a process, not so much for me, but certainly for the attorneys. And once we got through that, after we won in the Ninth Circuit on the appeal, my attorneys were like, look, the Supreme Court only hears 5% of the cases brought to them. And they were pretty confident that things were pretty cleaned up and it wasn't a bad ruling, and that for it wasn't a life, you know, my attorneys were like, they didn't think the Supreme Court would hear it. So to get that news that they were hearing it was somewhat devastating, because then they could overturn it, obviously. And one thing, the hidden thing behind this, is just the expense of it all. And the unknown of how do you get great counsel when, you know, I was just starting off my career. Fortunately, my God provides, and he provided for me in amazing ways. And I was able to have a former sponsor, or a sponsor from my Stanford days, a businessman named George Roberts, who extended his attorneys, and he took the bill. And obviously when we ended up winning, PGA Tour reimbursed us, but I had people come alongside me that met me in every way to help me through that. But certainly getting the news that the Supreme Court was going to hear it was challenging, because it meant this is going to continue and it's going to be expensive, and I had a lot of headaches.
We'll hear argument now, number 0024, PGA Tour Inc. versus Casey Martin. Mr. Farr.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court.
The court scheduled oral argument for January 2001, 3 days before the second President Bush's first inauguration, and just a month after the Supreme Court had ruled 5-4 in Bush versus Gore, and effectively handed the election to George W. Bush. It was a particularly tense era in the Supreme Court's history, and there were still a lot of hurt feelings between the court's liberal and conservative factions. The court came to the Martin oral argument ready to grapple with two questions. First, whether PGA Tour venues were places of public accommodation under the coverage of the ADA's Title III. And second, whether accommodating Martin's disability with a golf cart would fundamentally alter PGA Tour events. But for Martin, who attended the argument, it must have relieved some of his tensions when liberal and conservative justices alike quickly jumped on the PGA Tour's attorney.
And the results should be no different just because he's playing in the events.
Mr. Farr, the language of Part 3 of the Act literally could cover the player. It says it refers to any individual, and it refers to any kind of advantage or privilege on a golf course. So you have to construe it some way, it seems to me, to avoid that language.
That's correct, Justice O'Connor. I mean, the argument...
To reach your conclusion.
That's correct. The argument made by respondent is essentially that Title III covers any person who's present at a place of public accommodation, whatever he or she is doing there, whether they're a customer, an employee, or an independent contractor. I think that's wrong for several reasons. First of all, just looking at the specific language that you point to, the notion of full and equal enjoyment of goods and services, it seems to me, is quite different from the notion of being allowed to provide the goods and services.
Well, Mr. Farr, you keep talking about goods and services, but the statute is not limited to goods and services, as Justice O'Connor's question indicated. It covers the enjoyment of, among other things, privileges. And it seems to me the straightforward argument is that the person who is making a claim here is somebody who says, like any other member of the public, I paid my $3,000 and I got my two references, and I want to enjoy the privilege of competing at this place of public accommodation. Why doesn't it literally fall within that quite easily?
Well, if I may separate this into two things, because the $3,000 applies only to a very small piece, which is the qualifying tournament. There is no requirement playing on the tour itself,
right,
on the Nike tour.
That's where you start.
But that's where one starts. But in terms of privilege, I'm using the term goods and services not to skip over the others, but simply as a shorthand reference to all of that.
Well, except that it makes a difference, because I think in a common sense kind of way, we can say, well, he's not getting any goods and services. But he is trying to exercise a privilege of playing.
The discussion eventually turned to the second question on the justices' minds, whether letting Martin ride in a cart would fundamentally alter PGA Tour events. And the court seemed no more persuaded by the tour's position there than it had been on the first question.
Whether the modification that's requested here would fundamentally alter the nature of tour events. And I think that where the Ninth Circuit went wrong on that particular question is that it never really came to grips with what professional athletics are. The professional athletics are, as I said in the beginning, simply tests of excellence. There are questions of who can perform the best a particular set of physical tasks, and those tasks are defined by the rules of the sport.
But the PGA has let down its requirements in a couple cases. One golfer had been injured and he was allowed to go in a cart, was he not?
Never in a high-level tour event, Your Honor. There has never been a situation in the events we're talking about, which is the events on the highest level PGA tours, where they have allowed
Mr.
different
Farr, that's
people
not true as the qualifying schools.
That's Justice John Paul Stevens, the senior most liberal member of the court. And understanding the decision in the Martin case requires understanding a little bit about Justice Stevens. First of all, Justice Stevens was far and away the Supreme Court's most avid golf fan. But more than that, Justice Stevens had lived a rich life full of important experiences, and those experiences influenced the worldview that informed his jurisprudence. When he was a kid, Justice Stevens' father was indicted and convicted of embezzlement. But the Illinois Supreme Court eventually overturned the conviction for lack of evidence and criticized the prosecution. The whole episode heavily influenced Stevens' view of criminal prosecutions for the rest of his life. As a young man, Justice Stevens enlisted in the Navy on a Saturday, December 6, 1941. His service earned him a Bronze Star, but the experience of war soured Justice Stevens on the death penalty. Justice Stevens came to the court after he was nominated by President Gerald Ford, a Republican. And after decades of Stevens' evolution toward a more liberal jurisprudence, Ford said this in 2005, quote, "I am prepared to allow history's judgment of my term in office to rest, if necessary exclusively, on my nomination 30 years ago of Justice John Paul Stevens to the U.S. Supreme Court. End quote.
And the thing that puzzles me is how it can be a fundamental rule that applies that does not apply in the qualifying events.
Well, because the principal events that they put on are, of course, the events of the tour themselves, the two highest level events. Qualifying involves simply questions of logistics, to be honest. There are many more people who are playing.
If logistics are sufficient to justify use of a cart, why isn't this handicap sufficient?
Well, first of all, let me make...
Because they're both trying to determine the quality of the golfer. And one, it's not fundamental in qualifying schools, but it is fundamental in the tour event itself.
Well, let me make one point, that when carts are allowed, they are allowed for all players. So, and that is essentially because there are choices that the tour has to make at any particular time about whether there are enough caddies available, whether there's enough time on the golf course to get however many people there are through the event in order to produce whatever result they're looking for. With respect to the events we're talking about, the actual competitions on the PGA Tour, on the Buy.com Tour, which is the second level tour, the tour has always required that all competitors observe all the same rules, including the walking rule. There have been no exceptions to that whatsoever.
Mr. Barr, is your position then...
That's Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg.
A clear position that there is no accommodation required in a professional sport competition, that the rules are whatever they are, and... there is no requirement to adjust to any disability.
I want to make clear in two points. First of all, that when I talk about rules, I am talking about what we have called in the case substantive rules. And that is rules that are intended to and do have the potential to affect performance and the outcome of the tournament. So first of all, when I'm using the term rules, I am. Secondly, though, the question is if you're saying, do we mean that for any rule or any accommodation? I think the correct answer is yes. Although one sort of instinctively would think that there should be some process by which people can separate the performance-affecting rules that really count from the performance-affecting rules that don't really count, I actually don't think there is such a process.
After 25 minutes, Martin's attorney was up. He didn't get far before Justice Antonin Scalia, arguably the most conservative of the court's justices, challenged Martin's right to create an exception for a rule that the PGA Tour had deemed essential to its competition.
In 1997, when Casey tried out, there were something like 1,200 people, golfers from the public, who wanted to play on the PGA Tour. And they came in, paid their money, had their references, and started to play, and they winnowed it down to 168 players by the third stage. Every one of those 168 players is going to either go on the PGA Tour the next year or on the Nike Tour at the time, and none of those players need ever have walked a single hole, not only in the qualifying, but in their lives.
Mr. Ridden, all that proves is that you could play golf under different rules.
That's Justice Scalia.
Just as you can play baseball under different rules. Is the designated hitter rule, is it essential to the game of baseball that the pitcher bat?
There are two leagues. One league has it, one league doesn't.
They play under different rules, but every team in each league has to play under the same rule. Now, could a pitcher in the National League, which follows the traditional rule, could he say, I have some blood deficiency that means I get tired sooner than other pitchers, and therefore I shouldn't have to go up to bat. I'd like to sit in the dugout, because after all, the rule that the pitcher has to bat is not fundamental to baseball. Look at the American League doesn't have that rule.
Well, for the National League, it is fundamental, and it would not be permissible, because you would be changing.
Why?
Simply
because that's what they do. That's the rule of the game.
But Your Honor, I cite what happens in the Q School to demonstrate the fact that walking is not indeed fundamental.
All that it demonstrates is that you can play the game under a different rule. I mean, what? I don't understand the whole meaning of fundamentalness with regard to a sport. Is it fundamental to baseball that the strike zone be from the chest to the knees? It could be from the eyes to the hips, couldn't it? Would that make any difference?
Rules could be changed.
And could a player who has a disability, which means he which causes him to have an excessively long torso, could he demand that the umpire call strikes on him from his eyes to his hips?
No, he could not, Your Honor.
Of course he could.
Because
it's a silly rule. All sports rules are silly rules, aren't they?
I don't think it's a silly rule. I think it gauges how well the pitcher can control the ball and get it within the strike zone. Here we're dealing with something that isn't fundamental. Now, not only in the Q school, any Monday, a golfer with a 2 handicap and 2 letters of reference can go out to a PGA tournament that's about to be run that week.
A quick observation here. Justice Scalia, who died in 2016, was a really, really smart guy. He was famous for adhering to an interpretive philosophy called originalism, which is the idea that statutes and the Constitution ought to be interpreted and applied based on the original intent of that law's drafters. Justice Scalia frequently chastised decisions that, in his view, said more about the judge's personal preferences than what the law actually said. All that matters, Scalia always said, was the original intent of a law's drafters. In the Martin case, though, Justice Scalia clearly abandoned that approach. An originalist view of Martin's case would lead inescapably to a decision in Martin's favor. Title III's language is clear. It required his disability to be accommodated at places of public accommodation, which Title III explicitly defined to include golf courses. And there are no exceptions in Title III's texts for rules that a judge thinks are silly. And just as clearly, there's nothing in the rules of golf that requires walking. So using a golf cart doesn't fundamentally alter the game. From an originalist standpoint, then, Martin's case should be pretty open and shut. But Justice Scalia is lining up against him anyway. Justice Scalia has been accused from time to time of being less of a real originalist and more someone who used the appearance of originalism to do exactly what he criticized other judges of doing, which is finding a way to reach an outcome that jives with his personal preferences, no matter what the law requires. And Martin's case, in hindsight, is a prime example of that. Justice Scalia comes off like a judge less interested in the text of the ADA and more interested in finding a way to vote against Martin. It's not a good look. And perhaps Justice Scalia's colleagues on the Supreme Court agreed. Professor Siegel, who was Justice Stevens' law clerk, explains what happened after the oral argument.
They went to conference, which is where the justices discussed the case. Depending on what day of the week it was argued, might somewhat later in the week that they would have had the conference. And they tentatively voted. And Justice Stevens was happy that he was in the majority and was happy that he got indication from the Chief Justice, who assigns the case, that he was going to get to write the opinion set to work to write it. And he wrote it the way he always does. He was the only justice who wrote first drafts of his own opinions. So he wrote out a first draft and then shared it with my co-clerk, Joe Tai. And they went back and forth on a number of drafts and they got one ready. And then they shared it with my other co-clerks, Eduardo Pemelver and Ann Voits and I, and we did our normal process. And I think it was something they were very proud of. I know that you've read the opinion and probably reviewed it for this. And as you can tell, you know, they had a lot of fun. There's a lot of detail, a lot of discussion of the history of golf, the rules of golf. They were showing their expertise there. So they circulated the draft. And I knew it wasn't unanimous, but when word started trickling in on what the other chambers were doing, there was a dissent coming out. It was a little surprise, I think, when Justice Scalia's dissent came in, the first draft of it, just how sharp it was. You know, I think that, you know, and I think then that there was a back and forth, as there often is. Justice Scalia and Justice Stevens had this groove that they got into when one was writing the majority and one was writing the dissent, where they would almost challenge each other. So the drafts would grow by footnotes and they'd be responding back and forth. And often they'd done that on heavily politically charged cases, big culture war cases. I think that they had a lot of fun in this opinion, going back and forth in that way on a case that, you know, though it was important, important for the golf world and important for Americans with disabilities, was somewhat of a lower stakes than the presidential election or, you know, the rights of millions of people to immigrate.
May 29th, 2001 was a Tuesday, a day when the Supreme Court typically appears in public to hand down its decisions. And at 10 a.m. Eastern Time, the justices announced that they had decided Martin's case, with Justice Stevens announcing the court's ruling.
We first hold that the PGA does operate a place of public accommodation. The statute defines public accommodation in terms of 12 broad categories and specifically lists a golf course as one such place. Those courses are not only open to the members of the general public who play outside of the PGA tournaments, but they are also places that are open to the members of the public who either pay to watch those tournaments or pay to enter the Q school and or open qualifying rounds in order to obtain access to PGA's tournaments. Those competitors represent one group of clients or customers of the PGA who compete for prize money in its tournaments. Under the statute, the PGA may not deny those competitors, including Martin, access to tournaments on the basis of a disability covered by the Act. The statute does provide, however, that an entity does not have to modify its rules to grant access to a disabled person if the entity can demonstrate that the modification would fundamentally alter the nature of the activity. The critical question in this case is whether it would fundamentally alter either the games of golf, the game of golf in general, or the competition in the elite tournaments that the PGA sponsors, to waive the walking rule for Martin and to allow him to use a cart. The first part of the question is easy. Carts are now a common feature of the game. Their use does not affect a player's handicap and is not inconsistent with the fundamental character of golf, the essence of which has always been shot making. The more difficult question is whether the walking rule is an indispensable feature of tournament golf at its highest level. The PGA contends that any waiver of an outcome-affecting rule would fundamentally alter the character of its tournament events. The PGA relies on both common sense and the testimony of experts to support the proposition that the walking rule may be outcome-affecting, because fatigue may adversely affect performance, and a shot or two can determine the outcome of the tournament. In response, Martin relies on two findings made by the district court. First, for a variety of reasons, the fatigue from walking during the PGA tournaments is generally not significant. Indeed, many professionals prefer to walk. Second, and of greater importance, is the district court's uncontested finding that Martin endures greater fatigue with a cart than his able-bodied competitors do by walking. Since the sole purpose of the walking rule is to make fatigue a factor in the competition, and since Martin incurs greater fatigue than his competitors, even if he is allowed to use a cart, granting him a waiver of the rule would not impair the purpose of the rule. It therefore cannot be said to fundamentally alter the character of the tournaments. Because such a waiver is necessary to enable him to have access to PGA tournaments, which, as we have held, are places of public accommodation, it is a reasonable modification that the statute requires. The waiver will not give Martin an advantage over other competitors, but it will give him access to the privilege of qualifying for and competing in the athletic events the PGA offers to those members of the public who have the skill and the desire to enter. That is exactly what the Americans with the Disabilities Act requires. Accordingly, the judgment of the Court of Appeals is affirmed.
About 2,500 miles to the west, in Oregon, Casey Martin was still asleep. A few minutes after 7 a.m., his cell phone rang and woke him up. He didn't answer. But as the grogginess faded, he realized that it was Tuesday and that his phone call might have been about the Supreme Court. A few minutes later, Martin's home phone rang. This time it was the PGA Tour, and they put Commissioner Tim Fincham on the line. Martin still didn't know what the Supreme Court had decided. And so, with two words, Fincham told him, "You prevailed."
What was that like for you?
Well, it was a relief. I mean, it was over. There's no other recourse to that. It's, you know, set in stone. And it was a large relief for sure.
The decision that Justice Stevens wrote was fairly narrow, meaning that it didn't announce any sweeping, dramatic changes to the way Americans with Disability Act cases are handled. It focused singularly on the facts surrounding Martin's case, which makes sense, because principally what the ADA requires is an individualized determination of a person's right to an accommodation. Again, Professor Michael Ashley Stein of Harvard Law School.
Was the outcome of the case as predictable as the decision makes it look? Or does this, you know, you mentioned the fact that this case arose under Title III rather than Title I, which might have made more sense. Did that complicate it at all?
I don't think it complicated it for the court. It didn't seem to be a matter of great concern for it. But as far as the outcome being predictable, I certainly didn't think it was predictable at the time, and I'm not sure that it would be predictable currently. Being a disability rights advocate and lawyer, I'm of course happy with the decision coming out in favor of the plaintiff, but there are some very strong dissents. And, you know, Justice Scalia in particular was very active, one could even say ballistic, in his dissent. It marks in the Supreme Court's jurisprudence the time in which the justice was continuing to dissent on the basis of this is ridiculous, but kind of notched it up a couple of levels in the hyperbole, in the rhetoric, both off the bench and in the written decision. But stepping back for a minute, you know, we can sort of ask fairly, well, isn't there something in Justice Scalia's opinion? Right, he's pointing out that golf is not an inherent absolute. It's not a scientific absolute. The reason you have these particular rules are some kind of, you know, magical mixture of history, circumstance, and so on. And so aren't games and other things that are run by rules that are not somehow logically, dispassionately developed, shouldn't those be the ones that govern it? And in his opinion, the essence of golf is walking from hole to hole, getting exhausted, not having the accommodation of riding in a golf cart. On the other hand, you know, we could ask questions of the originalist Justice Scalia. Well, wait a minute, they're also no longer playing with wooden clubs or wooden tees. And the science and technology of balls has increased, you know, dramatically. It's no longer the same kind of ball. The people who are playing it are wearing glasses and other kinds of technological assistance, and that seems to be okay. So you could see both sides of the opinion. And certainly if you take what Justice Scalia says seriously, even if one does not agree with it, you can pull out some very strong arguments for why the outcome perhaps was not predictable.
What would happen, you think, with this case if it appeared at the Supreme Court today? On the one hand, as you say, we're better in some regards as a country, and you know, in bringing people with disabilities into the fold. On the other hand, this iteration of the Supreme Court is so much more conservative than the one that decided PGA Tour versus Martin. How would it go today, you think?
You know, my friends who actually engage in this work are continuing to avoid the Supreme Court at all costs. And that's the same for those engaging in other areas of work, unless they feel they need to go to the Supreme Court because there's no other choice. I don't know how it would go. I am moderately optimistic that there could be the possibility of small inroads and positives on the ADA if it went to the Supreme Court. And I'm in the minority on that. I think this case might have come out okay, maybe a lot closer than ultimately decided. I also wonder if, it wound up being settled, so we never got to see it at the Supreme Court. But I wonder if something along the lines of website accessibility and other sorts of moderately non-political cases might wind up doing better than people suspect. So I'm not sure.
On the day the Supreme Court announced the decision, Martin told Time magazine, "It would be my wish, my prayer, that I would start playing great and I could look back at this time and see a change in the way my golf game goes. But I don't think there's any guarantee that that is going to happen." Martin knows better than most that there are no guarantees in life. And in fact, he didn't start playing better. After the court's decision, Martin missed 3 of his next 4 cuts and finished 2001 with just 1 top 25 finish in 23 events on the Nike and PGA Tours. Over the next 5 years, even with his accommodation, the pain in Martin's leg got progressively worse. He played fewer and fewer events nearly every year, never made more than half his cuts. If nothing else, he proved that a golf cart didn't give him an advantage. He retired from pro golf in 2006 and agreed to become the University of Oregon's men's golf coach that same year. Ironically, Martin's last start in a high-profile golf event came in 2012. When he qualified for his 2nd U.S. Open at the Olympic Club in San Francisco, the same city where years earlier the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals had upheld Martin's verdict. With 20 years of hindsight, the legal merits of Martin's case seem somewhat unremarkable, a fairly straightforward application of a fairly straightforward statute. Some people still don't see it that way. As recently as 2011, Fincham, PGA Tour's commissioner during the Martin case, expressed no regrets about the way he handled the situation. "I don't have any regrets," Fincham said. "I think we handled it right." After learning of the Supreme Court's decision, Jack Nicklaus seethed. "I think we ought to take them all out and play golf," he said. "I think they'd change their minds. I promise you, it's fundamental." Nicklaus went on to play several events per year for 4 more seasons on the senior tour, where he was allowed to ride in a golf cart. But Paul Azinger, who had spoken out against Martin's case at the time, had reached a different view by 2012. "I was mistaken," Azinger said. "Casey Martin needed a break in that regard. He won his case, and I was happy for him." Even Nicklaus might have come around at some point.
I wonder if anybody like Fincham or any of the other people involved on the other side who testified for the tour, Jack Nicklaus's, Arnold Palmer's, Ken Venturi's, have any of those people ever come back to you and apologized or said, I wish I'd thought about this differently back then?
Not necessarily, not quite like that, but you can read between the lines. And certainly I've shared this before, but Jack Nicklaus' son, Gary, was a guy that I knew and played a lot of golf with. And I would see Jack a fair amount of times at certain events and whatnot. And he was always quick to come up and sincerely ask about me. And I got sick, an infection and some treatments in early 2002 and was in the hospital for a period of time. And he had called to check on me. And so you could tell that there was some concern. And then Gary relayed to me, he goes, "Look, Case," he goes, "my dad has been conflicted about this because the tour put a lot of pressure on him. And he initially thought he needed to do that. But as he got into it, he felt bad about it." So, is that an apology? Not necessarily, and I'm not trying to put words for Jack Nicklaus either, but that's what Gary relayed to me. And Jack had been super kind to me. So, you take that for what it is, and I'm thankful. I got nothing but love for him, and it's life, and it's worked out, and I'm grateful for those little gestures.
It would be great to finish this story with a happy ending, but it's not clear that that's in the cards. Only two justices remain from the Supreme Court that ruled 7-2 in PGA Tour versus Martin. For the seven justices who have either retired or died, their replacements have been overwhelmingly conservative and have pushed the court farther to the right than it has been in any of our lifetimes. It would be nice to think that the Martin case nudged golf toward being a more empathetic, accessible sport for historically marginalized communities, including people with disabilities. But when John Daly used a cart to play in the 2019 PGA Championship because of osteoarthritis in his right knee, the reaction was largely derisive. Even Tiger Woods, Casey Martin's old teammate from Stanford, piled on. At the very least, it would be nice to imagine Casey Martin living out the rest of his days, healthy, gingerly making his way around the University of Oregon campus. But even that might not be possible.
I read that you had an accident last year, and you're spending a lot of time on crutches.
Yeah.
How are you doing right now, and how's your leg?
Woo! Yeah, not great, honestly. I mean, so a year and a half ago, I stepped out to get my garbage, and there was some road construction, and there wasn't the road there. It was a foot lower than it normally is. It was dark, and I fractured my tibia, which is a fear of mine all my life. It's kind of why I had, you know, a golf cart when I played, is the fear of stepping in a chuckle and breaking my leg. And fortunately, it never happened. I was fearful it happened when I was 27, but it happened when I was 47. And so that healing process has been painfully slow. And unfortunately, I'm still in a brace and on crutches, even 20 months after it. So I've been in a real war that way. And I'm doing everything I can, taking some experimental medicine to try to get my bone to fill in. But it's been an uphill battle.
Professor Michael Ashley Stein,
where are we as a country right now on making this the sort of country that the ADA was designed to help us become, you know, a country that is more open and accommodating of people with disabilities?
If I was to put it in three buckets, we've got a wonderful bucket, we've got a terrible bucket, and we've got a to be determined bucket. The wonderful bucket is that all the evidence indicates that the day-to-day lives of people with disabilities, how to get around on a public bus, get into a library, get into a restaurant, all these things have improved dramatically. Life 30 years after the ADA is way better for those of us who have disabilities of whatever sort, that's for sure. Title III, again, what we're discussing today. As far as employment, we've been a complete disaster, a total failure. And that precedes the ADA. This goes all the way back in US history. And there's a long reason for it. Part of it is the chokehold we put people into of either getting healthcare through Social Security and otherwise, or going off and working, endangering their lives, not receiving their healthcare services. And the ACA and what happens with it, the Obamacare, is going to be a big determinant of where that goes. And then we've got the to be determined. The to be determined is going to be influenced by what this current Congress does regarding Social Security and other benefits. The previous administration was banging the drums for cutting back on many of them, which would have deprioritized many of the things that people with disabilities get in their federal benefits and allowing states to assign priorities that the community didn't want, maybe even pushing people back into institutionalization. And the non-legal side of it, the real world side of it, is frankly, we have not come far enough as far as social stigma, acceptance, the idea of seeing people with disabilities doing normal things as part of our everyday lives. We're only starting to see some movement on it as far as TV, movies, et cetera. And we don't see enough of it in the public sphere. So we're doing terrific, we're doing terrible, and we're doing yet to be determined.
Well, that's episode 3 of the Line 4 podcast. And one more thing, and this is important. This episode of the Line 4 podcast is dedicated to the memory of Jordan Hartzell. If you've spent much time on the no laying up, Line 4, Sweetens Cove sort of corner of the internet, then you've probably run into Jordan's father, Jim Hartzell, who is a Scottish golf guru and one of the nicest people on the planet. Jordan died unexpectedly on May 17th at the unspeakably young age of 21. And like his father, Jordan loved golf. And in lieu of flowers, Jordan's family has asked for donations in Jordan's memory to youthoncourse.org. And I'd like to ask for the same thing. If you'd like to support Line 4 this month, then the best way to do that is for a donation in Jordan Hartzell's memory to youthoncourse.org. Any amount at all would be appropriate. I really appreciate it. And I know that Jordan's family does too. This has been the Line 4 podcast. I'm Will Bardwell, signing off.